Well, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. You are in for a treat today because we talk automotive maintenance and repair with Gordon Fricke. This is always one of our most popular shows, and the lines get loaded, so call us early while we have a couple of open lines. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for over 30 years. He knows a shocking amount of vehicles. It never ceases to amaze me. Get your questions in now. You can also go to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC radio. Be as detailed as you can if you post your question that way. You can post comments at the bottom of today's Vox Pop show page, wamc.org/VoxPop. Or you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC VoxPop. Gordon Fricke, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Ray. Thank you.
So what's new? Anything happening?
Well, it's starting to warm up a little bit at least.
It's nice.
Boy, it took forever, didn't it?
Yeah. So now theoretically, it's the motoring season, yes?
Yes. Tire changes, get cars ready for trips maybe. All the stuff that got delayed, put off, or ignored during the winter might be coming out now in the form of problems, squeaks, rattles, shimmies.
Yeah. Well, I got to get my air conditioner recharged.
That's another one, yeah. A lot of air conditioning work will start cropping up the first really warm day we get.
Okay, well, I noticed it. You know, I have a little display, and it says coolant low, or not coolant, but refrigerant low, AC off.
Yeah, so your car's got this telltale system that alerts you to all these things.
Yes, indeed, and you might as well put dollar signs next to it. Let's see, although I think with one of my past DeVilles, I actually figured out how to do it myself.
Do a little backyard recharging?
But it's a trick because the computer turns off the compressor when it senses there's no
refrigerant left.
And you have to fool the computer. And it's, as I recall, I just may pay the extra money and have somebody who knows how to do it.
That might be a good idea. Get it really evacuated and recharged.
Exactly. Let's go to Michelle in Niskayuna. Michelle, you're on.
Hi, Gordon. I have a question about my 2001 Subaru Outback. When I'm driving, whether I'm accelerating or just idling at a stoplight, my car shudders as if it's running out of gas. It hesitates, and the engine almost sounds like it's about to stall, like it has no gas. But and when I'm accelerating on the highway, it will also do that, kind of at random intervals. But the thing is, I've noticed it only happens if I'm below a half tank of gas. So I'm wondering if you have any guesses about what might be going on.
How many miles are on the car, roughly? Do you know?
About 110.
Okay. Did this problem sort of come up suddenly, or it just started sneaking up on you?
No, very suddenly. It happened just, you know, I the first time it happened, I looked down because I thought maybe I was out of gas, but that's not it.
So if you were to fill the tank, the problem goes completely away until you're back down below a half?
That's right.
If that's the pattern, there is the possibility that your fuel pump is getting a little weak. And the more gas is in the tank, the more fuel is sitting on top of the fuel pump. And if it's borderline, having a full tank of gas is a little bit easier on the pump to get it to the engine under pressure than if it's close to empty. That's a possibility. A partially plugged filter will have a similar effect because it takes more pressure for the pump to push through the plugged filter. It's possible that it is a fuel pressure issue. And it's not that difficult to test for a shop. What you'd want to do is have the car taken in when it's acting up. Have it down below a half a tank, quarter tank, eighth tank. And they may want to do a fuel pressure system test. And they'll hook up some gauges. And if it is on the ragged edge of not having quite enough fuel pressure, that's possibly what's going on there.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for the recommendation.
Michelle, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. How often does one have to change a fuel filter?
You know, in the early years, it was a pretty common replacement item.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it was often as a year, 15,000 miles, and then filters got larger and they handled more debris. And I know a lot of car maker intervals were up to 30,000. It then became common to see some of them lifetime, or if you have a problem. And a lot of the filters now are non-serviceable. They're not anywhere where you can get at them.
Yeah.
They're inside the gas tank, and they're in the area where the fuel pump pulls all the gasoline in.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty large filter, a lot of surface area. And I guess maybe fuel has gotten better and cleaner and more nicely refined. And it's true, I'll get cars in that have, God knows how many years they've been with never a fuel filter change.
I mean, would you recommend it if a car is 8 or 9 years old or you have X number of miles? Hey, it's going to improve performance and or gas mileage?
Yeah, if it's a replaceable filter, there is a point where you should change it.
But why wouldn't they make them all replaceable if eventually, unless they're making cars to be disposable cars after X number of miles?
That may be some of it. I don't know if it may cost the car manufacturer less money to incorporate the filter in the tank with the pump rather than hang it under the car somewhere. And now you've got fittings, connectors, the filter itself, some type of bracket to hold it in place.
Yeah.
You got to wonder sometimes if it is about cost of production.
But the gas now is just because of detergents and everything else, it's not a huge issue. I mean, how do you know if you're driving along, your car seems okay, how do you know, hey, it's time?
Well, if you wait long enough, you'll start having symptoms. One of the symptoms will be, I get the feeling I'm running out of gas when I'm going up a steep, long, hard hill.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I pull out to pass a car, I get a quick burst of power as normal, and then all of a sudden I'm petering out and I don't have much power. And a lot of times it will be a clogged or partially clogged filter. And the first time you notice it, or the early symptoms, are when you really need a ton of power, and you're going to need the most gas flow at that point.
Interesting. Interesting indeed. Well, you know, now I'll be paranoid about that, driving home and driving everywhere this weekend. The number to call, Gordon, is 1-800-348-2551. Back to the phones we go, and we welcome Brian in Queensbury. Is Brian ready for us? Yes, Brian is ready for us. Thank you, our phone screener, Matt Don Diego, who is very diligent in screening the calls. Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Hi there. I hope you can help me because this problem has been driving me nuts for a long time now. I have an Audi 6 Quattro 2002 with 100,000 miles on it. And at 60 miles an hour, I get a minor vibration in the steering wheel. No odd noises, nothing. I've changed the rotors. I've rotated the tires. I balanced the tires. And still at 60 miles an hour, I get this minor vibration. Is it possible that one of the half shafts is out of balance? Or do you have any other suggestions?
What's a half shaft before we start?
What Brian is referring to is the drive axle that goes out to each drive wheel.
Oh, I see.
And half shaft was a British term years and years ago that they called them for vehicles that had a drive shaft per wheel. So they called it a half shaft because there was in a rear-wheel drive car of those days, there was two rear drive axles,
I understand.
They called them half shafts.
Gotcha.
Kind of a neat term.
Yep.
So, Brian, to answer your question, it is entirely possible since you have already done just about all the normal things that you would do to solve a shimmy. And,
mm-hmm.
and you said it does jiggle your steering wheel.
Enough to be really annoying.
If you go a little faster, does it go away?
Yes.
And if you go a little slower, it goes away.
Correct.
This is what I would do with that particular car. If I had it in the shop, I would put it on a lift and put a guy in the car and then slowly accelerate to 60 on the lift. So all the wheels are spinning, particularly on a car like your Audi, it'll turn all the wheels. And when it hits that 60 mile per hour mark, when the shimmy's occurring, somebody wants to be under the car and just look at everything and see if we can find out what the shake is. And it definitely could be a drive axle. And a very careful inspection of those axles might show that one of the protective boots has been torn for a while.
No, I've already checked those.
You bent the boots are all good?
Yeah, what I was considering was pulling the shafts out and have a shop check the balance on them and check the joints, but I haven't been able to find anyone that will do axle shafts.
Yeah, that was something that is and was done with conventional drive shafts with universal joints in them. But I don't believe there's any equipment to jig up CV shafts. But it's very possible that somebody could spot one of them shaking under the car at that point. And unfortunately, it may simply involve replacing the one that seems to be the suspect.
Right. I'm trying to diagnose which one it is.
Yeah.
And putting it up and running at 60 miles an hour certainly isn't for a Saturday afternoon.
No way. No, and certainly not by yourself.
I think you want to be under the right conditions and have the right shop and all that, so you're not driving off the lift at 60.
All right. Hey, Brian, thanks a lot. We got to take a break here.
Thank you for your help.
Appreciate it. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. More of your automotive questions coming up.
Support comes from Charles Padula, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady. Cosmetic dentistry utilizing Invisalign where teeth can be orthodontically moved without braces. PadulaDDS.com. Skidmore College Master's Program offering individualized graduate studies in a wide range of interdisciplinary fields. Masters at skidmore.edu. Carrie Haddad Gallery presenting color theory paintings by Paul Shushman and Urban featuring works by 7 photographers. Opening reception this Saturday from 6 to 8. CarrieHaddadGallery.com. And Cafe Capriccio, Chef Jim Rua working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grand Street in Albany, New York. CafeCapriccio.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Gordon Fricke, our guest. We talk cars once a month and trucks, sure. Anything with a sort of a gasoline engine, I'm sure you could tackle. 1-800-348-2551. And Mike in Albany, you're on.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 96 Toyota Camry. It has currently 175,000 miles. Every morning, the first part of the day when I start the car, I need to press the gas pedal in order to get it going. Generally, the remainder of the day, the vehicle's okay, unless it remains idle, you know, parked for about, I don't know, 6-7 hours, then I have to redo the steps, press the gas pedal, turn the key to get the car going. I brought it to a local shop. They did a complete tune-up, including changing the gas filter. Didn't solve the problem. I didn't bring it back because I thought that it was just going to be a waste of time. I heard your show this morning and looking for some advice. Where should I be looking into?
Okay.
Sure, Mike. What you're having happen there is not terribly uncommon, particularly given the age and the mileage. Your engine and just about all gas engines today have a device that routes some air around the throttle, and that provides the higher idle when you start the engine cold. And it's called a couple of different things. It may be called a idle air control valve or an idle stabilizer valve. But in any case, your car has one, and I would dare say that it's probably gummed up and stuck. And it's stuck in the normal idle position, which is where it spends most of its time. But when it cools off, that thing has to open up and let more air by. And what you're doing now in the morning by giving the car a little bit of what you used to call giving it gas, you're really giving it air. But that is providing that extra air to get your RPMs up enough to keep the car running. So usually it's a relatively straightforward service. So I think what you'd want to do is get your idle air controller cleaned and also have the throttle plate and throttle bore cleaned at the same time, because those things are very susceptible to gumming up and sticking. And the older the car gets, the more this can happen more commonly.
Hmm.
So I think that's what you got going on there.
All right, Mike, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the call. It's 1-800-348-2551. Gary in Kinderhook, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, Hal. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 94 Chevy Silverado. It's got a 305 in it. And when I start it, it starts great. And when I get it hot, I drive it to work about 20 miles. If I shut it off, it won't restart without me, like, putting it to the floor. It'll start, like, it's got a vacuum leak, which I've checked, and it doesn't seem to be that. But when it's hot, it won't start. When it cools down, it starts and runs fine. It'll run all day long fine, but when I shut it off, it won't restart. It sounds like it's flooding out when it does. And the one thing I did do to it was I changed the fuel pressure regulator in the throttle body on it. But I can't seem to get past that issue. If I have to stop someplace between home and work, I can't restart. It's kind of frustrating.
Oh, boy.
So, Gary, how long does it have to sit before it'll give you that starting trouble?
It cools right off, because I just drive it from home to work and back at the end of the day. So I don't know if there's a temperature period other than cooling right off.
Okay, in other words, let's say you're driving a truck, it's fully warmed up, you go into a store, for example, maybe for 5 minutes. Is that enough time where you'll have that warm starting problem?
No, not that I know of. I don't think I've given it that much, like I say, if I work with it and I stick it right to the floor, it'll kind of start, and then as soon as I put it in gear, it shuts right off again. But if I kind of play with the throttle a little bit, I'll get it going and it'll go again. And then it runs fine.
Yep. Probably what you've got is a leaking, I'm trying to think on a 94. That's throttle body injection, one or two big injectors under the air cleaner? Yeah.
Right.
I think you've got two fairly large injectors under there instead of eight individuals or six, depending on how many cylinders your engine has. What could very well be happening is they're leaking. In other words, when the engine is shut off and the fuel pump is shut off, the injectors are not supposed to drip or drizzle any gasoline out. But I think that maybe you've got one or both of your injectors that are dribbling gas out while it sits hot. And what that in effect is doing is it's pouring a bunch of raw gas into your intake, and you are in fact flooded.
That's what it sounds like. Yep. It sounds like it's flooding out.
And by you putting the accelerator to the floor, that opens the throttle plates up and lets the engine breathe in a whole bunch of fresh air.
Okay.
And that's what allows, I think, you to get it started and going. So here's what you can do. After you've driven it home and it's fully warmed up, pop your air cleaner off and just shine a flashlight under those fuel injectors, because you can see them on that vehicle, and watch for dripping. And if they're dripping, you can do two things. You can try to help it with putting some very strong fuel injection cleaner through the gas tank, a couple of applications. And if it's a dirty injector situation, this might clean it up and solve your problem at very little expense to you. But if you see those injectors dribbling down and you try that couple of doses of injector cleaner and nothing happens, you might end up having to replace them.
Is that expensive?
Well, it's not the worst thing in the world, but, it's not cheap.
Yeah.
But that may solve it.
Okay.
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
Good luck, Gary. Let us know how you did. Let's go to Tony in North Adams. Tony, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Yes. Good afternoon, Gordon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have an 88 Toyota pickup with a 22 RE engine. I have plenty of fuel pressure, good spark. The problem is when I start the truck, it takes 5-6 minutes to warm up. I've checked the injectors. I've checked the timing Any suggestions?
Well, when you say warm up, Tony, do you mean that it's not drivable unless it runs for that long of a period of time?
Yes.
Okay. It's not that your temperature gauge is slow to increase, but you just, so when you go to try to drive it prior to waiting that long, what is it? Just
it basically dies out.
Yeah, just won't go. How does it start?
It won't go.
How does it start cold? Will it start in the winter?
No, it won't. Okay. Well, it will, but you still got to do it either winter, summer.
Yep. And how long does it normally take before you can drive this thing away? Let's say this time of the year, this weather.
This time of the year, I'm saying probably 3 to 4 minutes.
And does it sit there and idle fine for that 3 to 4 minutes, or does it sound funny?
No, you have to hold your foot on the gas.
So it'll stall?
Yes.
Yep. But you can't drive away either?
No.
Okay. Here's what you more than likely have going on. It's very possible that the temperature sensor that tells the computer how cold it is, the engine and or the ambient air that's going in, if you have two sensors, one of them might be saying that it's way warmer than it really is. So the computer's all set up for 90 degrees, but it's really 40 out.
Uh-huh.
So that engine has to run a long time before it's fully warmed up and you can take off and go.
Right.
On a vehicle that vintage, it's not that easy just to plug it into a scan tool and read all those sensors, because prior to 1996, the testing was a lot more difficult.
Well, I'm a former Toyota mechanic. It's just the temperature sensor, is that going to be the one on the block?
I believe that's going to be located on the cylinder head.
Okay.
It's a four-cylinder, and I haven't seen one of those in a long time, but it's going to be somewhere, obviously, in the cooling system on the engine side of the thermostat.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
okay.
Tony, thanks a lot. You know, hearing you diagnose these problems, all these shows, it strikes me that we'd be all be better off if none of these cars had computers and we went back to the old, strictly mechanical way of doing business, and all of these expensive repairs go south.
Some of what you're saying is true, because I lived through, when I was in the early years, I experienced carburetors and points,
yeah,
and pure mechanical systems, and then fuel injection and electronics came in, and now they're full on, and everything is controlled by a computer. Sensors are reading everything.
Yeah.
The cars today perform and operate much better. They're more efficient. They don't stumble and stall.
But the great old cars, I mean, the really great old mechanical cars are still great cars,
yeah,
right?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And a lot of people will say they don't make them like they used to, but that's kind of a double-edged sword, because there's good and bad to that. So
yeah.
I can't say throw all this stuff away and go back to the old.
Well, they won't let us anyway.
No.
Regulations being what they are and all.
So what you got to do is get yourself a classic car.
Okay.
And have your points in your four-barrel carburetor.
Okay.
Or two.
All right.
And then, or three. And then then you got to drive your normal car.
Ah, I see. Just to have the other
yeah.
one. I see what you're saying. Okay. Let's go to Norman in Colony. Norman, you're on.
Yes, I'd like to say I agree with the comment you just made. I have my classics with carburetors and no fuel injection, and I love them. Having said that, my wife drives a 98 Volvo XC70 cross country. The speedometer is erratic, has been for some time. You go down the road, sometimes she works, sometimes you hit a bump, it stops. Should I be looking at the pickup or take the instrument panel out and look for loose wires?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you had any access to a scan tool, it'd be very interesting to see if they're
not throwing any codes.
Okay. I'm going to say that your problem more than likely lies in the instrument itself, in the speedometer. because okay. if it was the vehicle speed sensor, there's a lot of things relying on that signal, not just the speedometer.
Okay.
The computer needs that signal to shift the transmission,
right.
to vary things regarding engine timing and fuel delivery at certain points. So I'm going to guess, and let me ask you this, are you able to bang on the instrument cluster when the speedometer fails to get it to pop back up?
We haven't tried that yet, but I'm not opposed to
I would do that.
That
because okay. If you find that the speedometer drops down and is not working, and you give the instrument cluster a bit of a bang, not enough to crack the dashboard or anything, but enough to give it a little shock, and then all of a sudden, boom, that needle pops up almost instantly. Reproduce that a couple of times, and then you're probably looking at an instrument issue.
Okay. How difficult is it for me to pull the panel out?
It really isn't. It's not that bad, and okay. there are places where you can send that cluster to
okay.
and get it repaired. So you don't have to reprogram it. It doesn't have to go to the dealer. Your mileage stays where it was. The only downside is the vehicle will be out of service for whatever that period of time is. If you've got, if you've got another vehicle, then pull it, send it, let them fix it, and then you reinstall it, and you're going to be in good shape.
Excellent.
Anyone locally in the Albany Tri-City area?
He's really not allowed. I mean, if you want to email Gordon at some point, you can, but over the air, he's not allowed to make recommendations like that. I hope you understand. Hey, yep. Norman, what old car do you drive?
I have a couple of Lancias from the upper 70s, 79s, 81s.
What are they?
Lancias.
Oh, okay.
It's Italian, Ray.
Yeah, well, now I thought he said Lancer, Dodge car.
No, he's pronouncing it.
No, all right. You mentioned Dodge. I have a 1985 Plymouth Horizon, same thing as a Dodge Omni, with just under 26,600 miles in pristine condition.
Very nice.
Is it going to you're going to start taking it to any shows?
And I'm
not being funny because there will be a time when you'll see cars of that vintage that have been out of the picture for so many years. It's like going to a car show and seeing a 62 Rambler.
Yeah.
Inexpensive car, you know, nothing fancy, just bare bones transportation, but some that survived, you'll see them, you know?
Yeah, well, okay. Well, that's great.
I also have an 84 Rampage.
Oh, that little pickup? Those are kind of cool.
Yeah, it's just the epitome of simplicity. As long as your brakes, your tires, and your lights are good, you never have to worry about past inspection. You never have a check engine light,
That's what I'm talking about,
that's
Norman.
Right.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for the call.
Kind of guy.
See you
Thanks
later.
Thanks again. See you.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You know, when I was a little kid, my family had a 62 Rambler wagon.
No kidding.
Yeah. Almost killed my mother. The steering, she was on Academy Road, the hill, and the brakes went, and I believe in that one, the brakes were somehow connected to the steering column. So at the same time, she lost the brakes and the ability to steer.
No kidding.
I don't know how, what would, I don't know how these.
Well, they may have had, I don't know what those cars had for boost systems, but you know, there are some cars that I think shared power steering with power brakes. So I could see the steering getting hard and the brakes tough to operate.
Well, that was the last we saw the old Rambler. Let's go to Arthur in Climax. Arthur, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, I have a 2001 Ford F-350 with a 7.3 diesel. I'll be quick because I have to go to work. But what happens is, as I'm driving, once it's warmed up, I come to a stoplight, and no matter how far down I push the pedal, it just idles. I change the pedal itself because it's electronic, and nothing seems to work. It's a diesel, and I've changed quite a few things, and I can't figure out the problem.
Arthur, what year is your truck?
The 2001.
2001. And it's a 7.3 power stroke?
Correct.
Okay, yeah. You're semi on the right track, because when you push down the accelerator pedal, you're simply operating an electronic rheostat that gives your request to the computer. And then
right.
the computer decides what to do with the fuel delivery. And on those power strokes, you know, they're electronic injectors. That problem really needs to get scanned and diagnosed, because the cause could be a number of different issues. There were some wiring harness problems with that vintage truck. Some of the wiring connections to the engine. But what needs to happen is, it's pretty complicated. You need to get it scanned, and the technician wants to be looking at the information that when you're depressing the accelerator, the computer is seeing that request. And if it is, then why isn't it carrying it out? If it doesn't
right.
see it, then there's a problem between the accelerator unit and the computer not getting that signal.
Mm.
So it's not an easy put your finger on it, fix thing. You know, it's got to be diagnosed electronically.
Yeah, I tried. It's not throwing a lot of codes, so, I mean, it really is difficult. I know it has a position sensor also, correct?
Yes. Yeah, there's it needs to back up what you're requesting as to what's occurring. But with a diesel, the computer is not opening. There's no throttle plate on a diesel. It's
right.
It's all accomplished by fuel delivery. So the diesel takes out the fuel, it takes out the element of the throttle plate, so it's totally electronic.
Right.
So you got to get it scanned, and the data has to be read.
Arthur, we got to take a break here, but thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Gordon Fricke, our guest. We'll hit the home stretch next.
Support comes from Mount St. Mary College, Newburgh, presenting Junior Jumpstart, a visit and tour day for high school juniors on April 27th, msmc.edu. The Museum at Bethel Woods, with a Rolling Stone magazine photography exhibit on assignment, Woodstock, now through August 18th, bethelwoodscenter.org/museum. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. And Unison Arts Center, New Paltz, presenting singer and resonator guitarist Del Rey playing Women in American Music, plus country blues, classic jazz, and more, Saturday, April 20th at 8 p.m. UnisonArts.org.
one 800 348 2551 is our number. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Of course, you can contact us in many ways. And, well, Patrick Donges, our producer, is here to, what'd you get, emails?
We got an email. We got a little WAMC.org commenting action.
Okay, go ahead. Let's hear what you have.
Okay, Bob in Great Barrington on WAMC.org asks, I just got my first oil change on our used 2010 Honda Pilot with 45,000 miles, and the mechanic said it was 1.5 quarts low. Is that normal to be that low after 5,000 miles? The car is running fine. Should I have checked it out further?
That's an interesting question, because we're running into that cropping up more often now, and we see it more on vehicles that have a low oil warning system. In other words, a light comes on and says you're a quart low. And then the owner will say, I've never had to add oil to my other vehicles. But the question is, have they ever really been checked?
Mm.
All engines burn some oil. Some use more than others. The industry standard is still around a quart to 1,000 miles. And if you have...
Wow.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
It sounds like an oil burner of the olden days when you'd see blue smoke trailing behind a car. And you'd
yeah.
say, wow, that thing has had it. Now, most new cars, modern-day cars, don't burn that much, consume that much oil in that period of time. But... So I think, Patrick, it was at 5,000 miles had elapsed.
Yeah.
that would not be considered excessive.
Okay.
And a good thing to do would be, and of course, that's a pretty young vehicle. But it, as a vehicle gets older, you want to be concerned about the ventilation system of the crankcase. In the olden days, or some cars still have what's called a PCV valve. Make sure there aren't any leaks that you're not aware of. It could be dripping somewhere going down the road. And if your driveway is dirt or gravel, you don't see any spots on it. But that is not really considered excessive, but he should keep his eye on it.
Fair enough.
All right.
What else you got?
We have one more, couple of comments from Bob via email. That's voxpop@wamc.org. And he just says, this is regarding a couple of calls. Power loss could be due to a clogged catalytic converter in high mileage cars. Also, the shimmy in the Audi could be due to a tire belt separation in the rear tire. Speaking from past personal experience with an Audi, suggests that the owner move front to rear and rear to front. So that's for what it's worth.
Yes. Well, thank you, Bob's, and Patrick as well.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you very much, Gordon.
Gordon Fricke is our guest. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551. Back to the phones we go. What do you think the name says on that sheet there, Gordon? Is that Guy? Is it Guy?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the line, Guy.
Hi there.
Welcome.
I've got a 2000 Dodge Dakota extended cab four-wheel drive, and I notice that when it's slippery out or muddy out, that when I hit the brakes, my front wheels lock up and my back brakes do not seem to work very good. I can hear them whining a little bit. I can hear a little noise in the rear brakes. Oh, and I was wondering what could cause that.
I'm looking at your thing here. What year and make is your vehicle?
2000 Dodge Dakota.
Okay. Do you know if your vehicle has anti-lock brakes?
Yes.
It may or may not that in that vintage, but here's the way braking systems are designed. In the event of a full-blown panic stop, and particularly on vehicles that do not have anti-lock brakes, of which there aren't that many anymore, but the braking systems are designed so that your front wheels will lock up before your rear wheels will lock up. And at first you might say, that's insane. Why would that be the case? But if your rear...
You stop straight.
Well, that's right. If your rear wheels locked up before your fronts and you were at all into a turn, your car would spin out of control very, very quickly. Mm. It's to keep the rear wheels rolling, even if the fronts lock up. So you tend, like you said, you tend to still go straight. Now, that doesn't mean that your rear brakes are not as effective as they should be. So it'd be good to check to make sure their adjustments are proper. That's got drums on the back. And,
right.
And just make sure your rears are contributing as much as they're supposed to.
We've been through this. We've put new brakes in the rear, gone through all the brakes all the way around, even went to do put the rubber brake line in the rear.
Mm-hmm.
Replace that because we thought that might have possibly collapsed. And actually, if I'm sitting still and I've got it in park and I go to put it in drive and it's slippery out, the rear wheels will spin.
Okay. There's also a hydraulic unit that's involved here. It's called a proportioning valve. And that's
been replaced.
Okay. Been there.
Master cylinder has been replaced.
The what is the master cylinder?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you this. Are they just not as effective as they should be, or are they really not doing much at all back there?
I don't think they're doing much at all. I mean, we've even replaced the brake cylinders.
There's an interesting thing about the wheel cylinders that you explained. Did you replace those yourself?
No, I had a mechanic.
Okay. And I don't know if that's the case with this truck, but there were some model cars in the past that... when you ordered the wheel cylinders, the parts store would all sometimes ask you what the diameter of the piston in the wheel cylinder was.
Mm-hmm.
And if you gave the wrong answer and it took a smaller piston or a larger piston, your pressure on those rear brakes is going to radically change. Obviously, a larger piston is going to give you more surface area and more braking ability. It would be nice to know, to be 100% sure your truck has the correct wheel cylinders on the back, if there are choices, because no matter what you do, that will you'll never get the right amount of rear braking. And that was common on some older cars years ago, because the brakes would vary from one model to the next, and that wheel cylinder may interchange with another vehicle, but provide you with totally different braking power.
Interesting.
So that's what I would be interested in checking.
Well, Guy, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Jack in Monticello. Jack, you're on.
Yes.
Can you turn your radio down just a little bit, Jack?
I turned it off altogether.
Thanks a lot. You're on.
Okay. I have a 2007 Honda Fit. I start the car up. It idles fine. If the cold air sensitive light does not go off and I drive 3 or 4 blocks, the car will stall out. It doesn't matter if it's winter or summer. The car has to be warmed up before it goes. He asked Honda, and they said they'll do a diagnosis, and that would be $100. And I found the foreign car specialist, and he said I would have to leave the car overnight, and that would be $35. So I just wonder, is it a fuel injector problem, or is it like what the fellow had before with the throttle plates and the air intake control?
It's entirely possible that it has to do with the idle controller and the throttle plate. How many miles are on your car?
177.
Okay. When you get into those kind of mileages, a lot of this stuff does become quite relevant. So I would definitely, as just a matter of maintenance, if nothing else, get that throttle bore and plate cleaned up and clean that idle controller and maybe give it a dose of some really good, powerful fuel injection cleaner, run a tank through of that, and see if you get any improvement then before you really, you know, have to go crazy, you know, sending it to the dealer or getting it diagnosed. Those two things might help it, might take care of it.
You also put in a tank of the high test, although it calls for regular.
Well, the high test really isn't going to provide you with much of an improvement other than some high tests have more cleaners in the premium than in their regulars. But what you're looking to accomplish here is to get the fuel injectors and the pistons and all this stuff cleaned up in the fuel system. So you certainly can put the high test in. It's not going to hurt it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Jack, thank you. It's Jim's turn in Vermont. Jim, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a problem with my 2007 Chevy Impala. It's something with the shift interlock. I don't know if it's a brake position sensor or if there's another brake switch. But it won't, sometimes it gets stuck and I can't get it out of gear or into gear, out of park.
Yeah, you're not able to take it out of park at times.
Right. The button won't depress.
Yep. Yeah, not an uncommon thing with a lot of different cars. The first thing I always do is when it's not coming out of park, have somebody go out and make sure your brake lights are on when your foot is on the brake pedal.
Yeah, I've seen that, and the brake lights do work.
They do.
Yes.
Yep. Because the brake light signal also tells the shift lock it's time to disengage so you can take it out of park.
Mm-hmm.
That solenoid assembly can stick, and sometimes you can get in there and clean them up and give them a light coating of penetrating oil, some very very light fine stuff. If it's a car that has a characteristic issue of that, that might solve it. Is your car a floor shift or a column shift?
Floor.
Floor. Yeah. You want, what we see happening sometimes is spilled liquids get into that floor shifter. Coffee, soda. Soda is just, will raise a cane with it. It'll gum up everything in there. So, you know, if you think anything's ever spilled down in there, that could definitely be a cause.
Well, I don't see a whole lot of debris from wet, you know, like soda. I have been able to pull the top off, and I can look down into there. There's no button or anything to release it, though, huh?
Some cars have an override, and others don't. They all should, but not all do.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, if you can get that cover off and with the key on, step on the brake pedal a bunch of times and follow the noise, and if you can see anything down there moving, give it a spray of some very light penetrating oil.
All right, I'll give it a shot.
Okay.
Jim, thank you. Let's go to Will in Sheffield. Will, you're on.
Oh, hello, how are you?
Good.
Good. I had a question concerning my 93 Toyota pickup, two-wheel drive, four-cylinder. It has some inconsistent throttle response. I've replaced the throttle position sensor, and that didn't take care of it. Sometimes it picks up just fine, and sometimes it sort of lags a little bit when I press the gas pedal. And that's, I don't know if it's related or not, but intermittently the check engine light comes on, but it doesn't seem to correspond to the throttle response.
Okay. Will, have you ever scanned for the check engine light codes to see what's going on there?
No, it's actually it's so inconsistent that the check engine light I haven't thought to bring it in or not, you know, I can't really make it happen.
Yeah. Even though the light is off, if the light came on, it'll leave a history code.
Oh, okay.
Very interesting to see what that code is, because that could totally lead you or somebody to the cause of that problem.
Yep.
If that vehicle has what's called a mass airflow sensor, it's always nice to clean those. There's a special spray that cleans up the part of them that senses the incoming air. And just check for the usual things like vacuum lines, hoses cracked. You know, even though that usually won't give you an intermittent problem, it's nice to rule out all the basic stuff under the hood. You might stumble upon a cracked hose somewhere, and it's drawing in air where it shouldn't. So okay. I would try that first and get it scanned so you can see if there's any history codes in there.
All right.
Okay.
Will, thanks a lot. Let's go over to Ozzy in Colony. Ozzy, you're on.
Hey, I got a 2004 Chevy Silverado that developed a piston slap, and I was wondering, it's got 120,000 miles, and I was wondering how much longer I can drive the car.
And it's what model Chevy again? A Silverado?
2004 Silverado with a 4.8 liter.
Okay.
A piston slap is what?
Well, a piston slap is a kind of a rattling, dull, clunking sound that comes from the engine.
Okay.
It's very common. Most engines do it. Some you barely hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Some you really hear it.
Okay.
And it usually is not detrimental to the engine. It's more of an annoyance than anything.
Yeah.
And it has to do with the fit of the piston to the cylinder. And the piston actually rocks a little bit, and it makes a rattling sound. GM had some issues with their V6s probably in the 2000s, and Ford had some issues with their V8s in the 2000s. And if the customer was upset about it enough, they would replace the engine and or the pistons. So if it is piston slap and it's nothing else, you may not really need to do anything about it, because it generally does not cause engine damage.
Doesn't get worse?
It can, but it may not be a big problem, because Subarus have done it for years, and I've seen them with 200,000 miles on them still making that clattering sound.
What about the wristing? Does the wristing also cause the same problem?
It sure could, but determining that is a tremendous amount of work. You got to take a lot of the engine apart to make that determination. So I think an engine guy should listen to it and give you an opinion.
All right, Ozzy, that's where we will have to leave it. It is just about time to close up the show. So, you know, it's funny how some shows just sort of go along on one topic. And today was acceleration.
Yes.
And gas lines.
Yep.
And
that's interesting, because we had a ton of questions previously. Fuel economy was last month's
yeah.
show. Everybody was interested in gas mileage issues.
I wonder what. We have to do a longitudinal study and find out if maybe it's weather-related or you know, it's very interesting.
It very well could be.
Well, Gordon Fricke, nice to have you here. Support for the program comes from Snow Farm Williamsburg, a New England craft program offering creative arts workshops taught by master craftspeople for adults and teens, beginners and up, snowfarm.org. Don Muller Gallery, Northampton, Massachusetts, specializing in jewelry, custom designs, handcrafted glass, and gifts by American artists since 1978. Facebook and DonMullerGallery.com. Oblong Books, presenting poet Duncan Christie and his new collection, The Running Sonnets, in celebration of National Poetry Month, Saturday, April 20th, 4 p.m. in Rhinebeck, oblongbooks.com. And Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York, providing legal and consulting services to life insurers in the changing regulatory climate, currancompliance.com. That's it for today's program. Thanks for calling in. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Gordon will be back next month. Thanks again for joining us, Zach Malloy, our engineer. The phone's answered by Matt Don Diego, our producer, Patrick Donges. Tomorrow at this time, it's Moyers and Company.
And next week on Medical Monday, Dr. Paul Lemansky will join Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.